For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
The important point here is that it looks like any other virus, or they didn't have symptoms from the virus. Even clinicians in hospital missed it.
That was Dr. Leila Ibrahim, a paediatrician at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne and a researcher with the Murdoch Children's Research Institute. She and her colleagues have published a study in the MJA about what COVID-19 looked like in children who presented to hospital during 2020. They found that most children had mild COVID-19 and most needed no medical intervention. And in fact, there is an argument for managing such children in the home. Of course, the study was completed in 2020, before the emergence of the Delta variant. The big questions now are, how severely are children affected by the Delta variant, and whether children should be vaccinated against COVID-19. Dr. Ibrahim and one of her colleagues, Dr. Nigel Crawford from the MCRI, are my special guests today. This research you've done, was that done before Delta variant showed up?
That's right, Kate. This data was collected from February 2020 until to the end of September.
Tell me, what does COVID-19 look like in kids? Is it different from how it looks in adults?
So our data from the study included nearly 400 children who tested positive for COVID in Australia in 2020, which shows that COVID looks like any common virus in children. About a third had no symptoms, and of those who did have symptoms, only half had fever. 70% had a runny or stuffy nose, and a third complained of a sore throat. Some children had diarrhea, headaches, or difficulty breathing. And the important point here is that it looks like any other virus, or they didn't have symptoms from the virus. Even clinicians in hospital missed it. In our study, 4 out of 400 children made it through the ED and to a hospital ward without COVID precautions. So they didn't have the viral symptoms typical of COVID, or they had other illnesses and coincidentally tested positive for COVID. Clinicians, for example, wouldn't typically think of COVID when they see small babies or infants who present with non-specific tiredness or lethargy. But this is the important message of this paper, that it can look like a different illness or not having symptoms at all, or any other common virus.
So should we be standardising a COVID test for any kid who turns up with a sniffle, or even any kid who turns up without a sniffle?
So we have certainly standardised testing in Victoria that I can comment on for children who have a sniffle. But I think, the important message from this study is that one particular lesson is about the neonate group, so babies 4 weeks or less, who present with really non-specific lethargy. We should also, in addition to ruling out very serious bacterial infection, which is what we typically do as pediatricians in this age group, we should also think of COVID.
So a high level of suspicion.
That's right.
This is also the very start of the pandemic when we weren't sure what this was going to look like. So again, acknowledging the PREDICT network, the Emergency Department Network of Australia, which helped run this study, was really trying to get organised to say, oh, what does this look like, you know, the context of pediatrics compared to adults. So we're hearing from China very on that it did look quite different in their scenario, right from Wuhan. They published the New England Journal very early on that kind of case series, and it was looking like it wasn't as severe as what we were hearing in the adults, and that fitted with the early SARS viruses also seemed to be more severe. So this was really a lesson in trying to identify what symptoms children might present with. I think we had 51 or 12% were actually admitted to hospital, but a lot of those were actually hospital in the home, which we might talk to a bit later, and you know, were really there for observation. We know some states like Queensland were pretty much admitting every child with COVID because they wanted to really be watching them closely and understand the transmission and et cetera within that family, and worried about community exposure. So it's very much been a lesson in what does this infection look like in children, and then a few ending up in the intensive care, but small numbers again, predominantly in Melbourne, Victoria with our second wave. So it's very much a picture of COVID in a low incidence country, which obviously Australia has been to date.
Do we know what the kid who gets it severely looks like in comparison with most kids who get it mildly?
Yeah, so I think you're talking about perhaps what we can do to predict who's going to get severe COVID.
Yeah.
One of the first things to say is that we've had very low numbers of children who've had severe COVID. In this particular study, there was only one child who had severe COVID. And this particular child would not have been missed in the emergency department. This child would have been presented very sick.
Yeah, so again, I think it does reflect Australia has actually done really well, you know, managing COVID more broadly. So again, we know in the middle of an outbreak, and we'll talk to that a bit later on. But overall, we've obviously managed the disease burden. So to really look at the risk factors, we have to go to other countries. And the United Kingdom has just published a little bit of data on their intensive care admissions. They had, I think, 250 children admitted over a 12-month period to February of this year. Yep. And they did identify some risk factors, which are similar to those in adults and the current sort of 1B prioritisation, you know, population. So they found that those with underlying severe cardiac conditions, so congenital heart disease would fall into that for children. Obviously, wrote about some of the longer term respiratory, you know, underlying chronic respiratory illnesses. Also those that are immunosuppressed, a group that you need to monitor closely. But probably one important one in children is the complex sort of neurological conditions. So those with quite severe epilepsy also seem to be a risk factor for getting into hospital, in particular ICU, and also weight. So obesity has come out as a risk factor in the UK study. So this sort of work coming out of those countries can really help, you know, inform some of our deliberations around who that might be at highest risk and therefore a lower threshold for presenting to emergency department with symptoms and then appropriate management, you know, as needed in hospital.
Talk to me a little bit about pediatric inflammatory multisystem syndrome, Layla. What is it and why is it associated with SARS-CoV-2 in children sometimes?
So pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome, temporally associated with SARS-CoV-2 or PIMS-TS, is a severe delayed immune response to COVID infection, which results in uncontrolled inflammation. And consequently, tissue damage. And this usually occurs within weeks of the initial COVID infection, but can be even longer than weeks. In many cases, children are asymptomatic of the acute infection. So they don't even realize that they had COVID, or they were only mildly affected. But then during the PIMS-TS presentation, the SARS-CoV-2 serology is positive, and that's how we know they've had COVID infection in the past. There's an overlap with some features of two conditions that pediatricians are very well aware of. That's Kawasaki's disease and toxic shock syndrome. Mm-hmm. They present with really high fever, gastro symptoms like diarrhea and severe tummy pain, conjunctivitis and rash. And involvement of the heart is really common as well. So in contrast to acute COVID-19 infection in children, PIMS-TS appears to be a condition that's more severe, with a really large proportion requiring critical care or admission to ICU. But generally, the outcomes have been good, particularly in the Australian context, where we haven't had many cases.
In the first half of last year, we started to hear about Kawasaki syndrome being associated with COVID in children. Are you thinking now that that was more likely to be PIMS-TS?
We haven't seen an increase in Kawasaki's disease overall. So again, through our surveillance network group called the PEDS, Pediatric Active Enhanced Disease Surveillance, or the PEDS network, which is across the tertiary hospitals in Australia, led by the National Centre in Sydney, have been monitoring Kawasaki disease for some time. And initially, you're right, because of the similarities, we're interested, was this Kawasaki's like, or was it Kawasaki's disease? But no one's ever identified a clear cause of Kawasaki's in terms of infections or other causes. So it's in the spectrum, but it's separate, and it does require for confirmation, really, either confirmation of the virus previously or serological testing to say that they've been exposed to the virus and then presented, you know, in the way as Layla's described. So definitely an associated syndrome. As mentioned, learning from our UK colleagues and those same studies I was mentioning earlier, they've had around 300 odd cases in the UK. Again, we learned from them around the management, starting some of the anti-inflammatory treatment, particularly quite early, has really helped with the management and minimising the morbidity of this condition. And the two cases we've had in Melbourne mentioned in this paper have done well, but were really sick in ICU and needed that high level care. So one in at Monash and one at RCH, both recovered well, which is great.
I'm chatting with paediatrician and researcher Dr. Layla Ibrahim and Dr. Nigel Crawford, the leader of the Surveillance of Adverse Events Following Vaccination in the Community group at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, about COVID-19 in children. Their research is free to access at mja.com.au. There is also an editorial by Professor Mary Louise McClaws from the School of Population Health at UNSW Sydney called COVID-19 in Children, Time for a New Strategy, which you may also find interesting. It is also free to access. Thanks for listening to this podcast. You can find all our previous episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, and you can subscribe to our feed through Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Back to our chat. The conclusion of your paper was that the clinical course for most children is mild, and that ambulatory monitoring or hospital in the home might be the effective strategy for reducing presentations. How has Delta changed that picture, or do we not know that yet?
We certainly don't have much data on Delta variant currently on children in Australia. We will see even fewer numbers, hopefully, with the Delta variant. And so putting our data together will help answer those questions. But with the Delta variant, I think it's increasingly important for clinicians to really think about why we need to admit children to hospital. So the data that we have in this study showed that very few children actually received any medical intervention in hospital.
Right.
So a large proportion were admitted for observation, which hospital in the home can do very well. So typically the HIT service is used for delivering antibiotics through a drip or even chemotherapy to our cancer patients in the home. So it's a hospital level care that we deliver in the home. And so we can certainly do, for example, hydration assessments or monitoring of oxygen levels in the home under the hospital in the home team, which means less exposure of COVID to the hospital environment and certainly to the vulnerable patients in hospital.
Kate, just adding to that, I think one of the benefits of these programs of research that I've mentioned through these networks like Predict and PEDS is that we're monitoring for that across the country. So clearly our colleagues in Sydney will now be expecting to see some cases through the Delta strain presenting to their hospitals and potentially some PIMS-TS cases we were talking to more recently, where places like Perth, who are part of our network, seen very few cases in children. But we're definitely organised to help understand that, you know, over time and be able to describe the number of cases. We know that Delta is definitely more transmissible. So we're hearing it's at least 2% more transmissible, but the severity is still a little bit uncertain, and that includes in children. But again, obviously the UK and other countries will give us, you know, some information to be able to compare their data sets of what they saw last year compared to what they're seeing this year in terms of those ICU rates and other interventions. So that data will come to hand, and I think will also be really important as we think about some of those, you know, preventative and other strategies.
We're obviously hearing more about kids catching Delta, or at least transmitting, showing that they have Delta. Do you anticipate that we're going to need to dig down deeper into that? And how do we get that done on a public health scale?
So in terms of transmissibility, I think we've seen from, you know, school camps in America and other places that there's been very much super spreader events or spreading. And you're right, within the schools, there's a few programs that are set up to try and monitor that transmission. I know definitely Sydney and Melbourne have some school-based studies trying to understand the transmission. Is it coming from a teacher or a student? And, you know, that circulation will be important. And because we have the hospital system set up, we'll be able to measure how many of them come into hospital. And is there a difference between the adolescents and the young, you know, adults? We've sort of heard that obviously the 18 to 25 year old seems to be a higher transmission, but we can measure the viral load in the nose and the number of people that get transmitted to try and understand the transmission, not just within the family, but also within the schools and other contexts. So I definitely agree that's something we need to understand better. In Australia, because we're organised with the genomic sequencing and can understand all of that, as you mentioned, in Queensland, we're in a good position to start to answer some of those important questions.
What we frequently hear in the media is really high-level data about admissions to hospital, but we don't actually know what's happening in hospital. That's the kind of detail that we collect as researchers. Is it just for observation, or is it just fluids? And that's the kind of detail that we need to be able to answer how severe is Delta on children.
Should children be getting vaccinated?
The first point is that we are already vaccinating 16 and older. So we have a licensed product. The Pfizer vaccine currently is licensed to 16 plus. So that is being administered to those that fall into the 1B categorization, which includes some of those risk factors I mentioned in terms of immune suppression or chronic respiratory or other cardiac conditions. So we are already administering the vaccine to those populations. And our international colleagues are already doing that. So the United States, Canada, Israel, are already running programs across the board in terms of healthy individuals. But other countries like the UK have decided to pause for a moment and are not giving it routinely in the schools at this point in time. So it's very much globally, there's a lot of interest in vaccinating children. I think the initial focus should be on those higher risk children, as we've mentioned, as we've gone through that prioritisation here in Australia, similar to other countries with that 1B group, need to be protected. the next question then comes, you know, do you need to run through a more formal school program, and therefore impact on transmission and Delta is clearly an important question here. The last comment to make is that New South Wales has vaccinated the year 12 students, we know, and through our research here at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, we're really interested in the not just the health aspects, but also the other mental health and other aspects. And year 12, missing school, big year, big impact last year in Victoria, looking like it's going to have a big impact in New South Wales, maybe in Queensland as well. And it's not just the health, it's also the protection, both of the students and the teachers and that community that leads to important educational outcomes. So we're really keen for those sort of decisions to feed into the decisions as they're made, not just purely the, you know, the health impacts, which are important for both the individual and the school, but the other impacts of COVID as well.
Should AstraZeneca be going to kids?
AstraZeneca is not licensed for children under 18 years of age. Right. It's not licensed currently. And I think in the current, you know, regulatory space, I'm not aware of AstraZeneca requesting that to go to younger age groups. So at the moment, it's a licensed product for 18 and over only. The only thing I want to say about the rollout is hopefully this discussion, we've really flagged that kind of international lessons that we've learned and sort of watching the vaccine rollout, obviously, you know, Operation Warp Speed in the United States and the vaccine development. It's been amazing that we've had vaccines come so quickly, and Australia's been in a position to understand and learn from our colleagues in North America and Europe and the United Kingdom, some of which have varying levels of protection, both in terms of infection, but also then with the vaccine. So it's been a real global issue. And even now, global access to vaccines is still a major issue. So some of our close neighbours, Indonesia, have really high levels of COVID and are struggling to roll out the vaccine in the setting of trying to manage the pandemic. So just realising that this is still a global issue, there's sort of global equity issues around access to vaccines and then the health of children, both in terms of the infection, but also those non-infection effects in terms of schooling and economic and other consequences of that, which are really important to children as paediatricians we're interested in. Just think of this as a global issue, not just a local one.
Layla, what would you like to see next in terms of research? What's on the horizon?
We are actually continuing the work. And as you mentioned before, Kate, it's really important to pool the data on the Delta variant. That's the big question right now. So we're continuing to work with our collaborators across Australia in the PREDICT network, in the various emergency departments across the country.
Is there one specific question you absolutely want to get answered?
I would like to know, is severity different with the Delta variant? The key messages that I wanted to get across is that, especially to reassure the parents who have children today who are COVID-19 positive, have found that COVID affects children mostly mildly and does not require medical intervention. And two, they can be managed in hospital in the home safely. And for clinicians then, if a neonate presents to hospital with lethargy, think of COVID.
Nigel, any last thoughts?
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to add was that in our paper, we found that 73% of those that were positive had a contact that we could identify.
Yep.
So we're really interested here at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute to understand that transmission. And my colleague, Shanann Tosif, who's on the paper and worked closely with Layla, has led some of our work looking at family transmission. So sort of understanding who was the index case and where did it spread within the family. Was the whole family positive or just one or two members? So understanding that kind of dynamics within family transmission, but then also more broadly, we've touched on some of that school, you know, transmission or community transmission, particularly amongst young people. And is that changing over time with the Delta strain? So is that changing amongst adolescents, 15 to 16 year old? Are they different to a 25 or a 30 year old? And that understanding transmission is important. So that's a really important research question we're interested in here.
Thank you both for your time. My thanks to my special guests today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.